This is 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. The Electric Drum is here with Jose Candelario, and today I'm joined by Bruce Trammell, author of The Villas Coach. Thank you very much, Mr. Bruce.
Well, thank you, Jose, for having me here today.
Tell us a little bit about where you're from.
Well, I was born in Brooklyn, New York. I lived in Brooklyn, lived in Bronx for the first 9 years of my life, and then I came to New Haven, and I grew up in New Haven.
How was your life in New Haven? How old were you when you got here?
I was about nine.
Oh, what schools did you go to?
I went to Conti School because I lived right across the street from Conti at one point. So I also went to Eli Whitney Tech.
Okay.
And I learned auto mechanics there.
Oh, okay. Did you eventually move on? What was your professional experience?
Oh, man, I've been in a lot of different places. I worked as an auto mechanic first, and then from there, I started fixing machines for Pitney Bowes. I was fixing copiers. I ended up at IBM fixing typewriters. You know, that's really, you know, going back, right? Typewriters. And then from there, I ended up driving trucks. I drove 18-wheelers and all. And then I got into the court system. As a paralegal later on in my career. And then I ended up in fatherhood from there.
Very good. Let's go back a little bit. You say you grew up around Conti School.
Mm-hmm.
How was the neighborhood like back then?
The neighborhood was basically, it was Black, it was Puerto Rican, and it was Italian. And we all, you know, lived in that little area together, you know. You know, it was... You know, everybody was close in a way, you know. You know, we had our little dust ups every once in a while, but it was, you know, just something the kids did. And then we came back together because that was a K-8 school at the time. So, you know, you just spent all those years, you know, in that one school. So everybody really grew up together.
How much has that neighborhood changed since you were there?
It's changed because the projects was the feet of Franklin Street and Hamilton Street. And now, you know, that's they redid it. So I'm not sure, you know, who's in there now. Some of the old families are gone. But on Wooster Street, it was mostly Italian. The Italians and Spanish came from that area. And so, you know, that really hasn't changed a lot over the years, you know.
You went to Eli Whitney.
Eli Whitney.
How was that experience? And because I know that's a very diverse school also.
Eli Whitney was rough.
Oh.
Eli Whitney was really rough because I ran into racism for the first time. You know, I didn't have it at Conti. You know, I mean, everything was, you know, everybody was the same. But in Eli Whitney, people were coming from all over, you know. And I was the only one that came from my school. So I didn't have a group that I, you know, could hang out with. A lot of kids, they came from either North Haven, they came from East Haven, they came from all over, you know, other places in New Haven, you know. So there were New Haven guys who I didn't know, you know, so I wasn't really connected to them, you know. So they had their own little group. So I had to find, you know, a group that I could feel comfortable with, but it really wasn't that easy to do. And that was 4 years that I couldn't wait to get out of there.
Wow. But it did not stop your development, fortunately. How was your family life? How did you grow up with your parents? Or
I'm the oldest of 10. Yeah, man, really. So, you know, with two parents, you know, in the home, being the oldest of 10, you know, my dad was a real big figure in my life. You know, he took a lot of time with us, you know, to give us the tools that we needed, you know, talked to us a lot, you know, taught us a lot of things. You know, my mom would stay at home, so she would be there when you came out of school, you know, so that part of it was supportive, but, the high school was just the roughest part of my growing up.
Oh, wow. You said your dad was there providing you lessons. Any good stories from your dad?
Oh, man, I got a lot of good stories from my dad, you know. when the trials came to New Haven, you know, the Panther trials, we walked downtown to see if we could get in, and we couldn't get in. He wanted me to have that experience, you know, but it was just so many people down there, man, trying to get into that courthouse, you know, to see what was going on. So we didn't make it, but I was aware of it because on Chapel Street, where I lived, you know, Chapel goes all the way down to downtown. Well, they were posted up on Chapel Street, the armed guards, you know, that were coming down to if there was a riot, you know, and I happened to be going downtown, you know, and I walked by and I'm like, whoa, you know, these guys standing there in the street, you know, with rifles in their hands, you know, and they're not moving. They're just standing there. And I'm, you know, I was running at first and then I stopped. And I started walking by them, you know, and nobody's saying anything. They're all standing straight, you know, and I was like, wow, that was, you know, that was interesting. For a kid, you know.
As a kid, your first experience with, wow. Did your mom was around also?
Yeah, yeah.
My mom. What kind of values did she instill in you?
Religion. We grew up in a religious household, you know. And my mom, she was the kind of mom who she led by example, you know. So you know, it was important to her to for us to have religion. So my father. Also, you know, that was important to him because he had finally, you know, accepted the religion that she was in. So now he was all in. So, you know, we were, you know, shirt and tie, you know, dress, going to the hall. Hmm. You know, we all went to the Kingdom Hall at that time.
How did you take these values throughout your work career? How did they help you out?
They helped me out a lot because my dad taught me one thing is that everything that people tell you isn't always for you, you know. He says you listen to it, you know, you assess whether it's something that, you know, you can hold on to or something that you throw away. So I had that. And then he also taught me that the truth is always going to be the truth, no matter how you look at it. And, you know, he says you could toss it around all kind of ways, but it's still the truth. So those values helped me to understand that not everybody would have your best interests at heart when you met them. So you had to, you know, assess whether or not something was, you know, what they were saying was positive and it worked for you, or if it was just something that was maybe an urban myth, you know, something like that. So that helped me to be able to protect myself in that way and not be led, you know, by somebody's fast talking or something, you know, because I knew about hustling, you know. I knew how people would hustle you. I got that from my uncle in New York, you know, who, you know, taught me about that. So I wasn't, you know, gullible, you know, to what people said. So I never got into the things that everybody else got into. Hmm. You know, I was kind of like, you know, the church boy, you know.
You many of your friends, though, lose themselves in the streets and that fast life. What was the difference between you and them? I guess religion? And
my father sitting in the window across the street from Conti School. And coming to the school unannounced, because he worked a shift that was 4 p.m. to 12 o'clock. So during the day, he's home, you know. So he would walk in, right, and he would, you know, check on us. And then he also knew he got to know the kids, too, you know, because they would see him in the window. They would speak to him. You know, they would see him at the school. You know, Bruce, your dad is here, you know. Mm. So that's what it was, because when they would get into something, they would tell me, nah, man, you go home. You know, you ain't a part of this, you know. You ain't gonna, you know, because I want to deal with your dad, you
know. Well, just being there.
Yeah.
Was he a disciplinarian or just, but just being there was enough?
He was a disciplinarian, but he was also, he talked to people. He talked to the kids, you know. When we first got here, we were living in Hamilton, Franklin Street, projects, right? He would play chess outside, and some of the kids would come by, and he would talk to them, and he would play chess with them, teach them chess, you know. So he did that in places like McDonald's and other places around town, taught me how to play chess. And so people would come up to him, and he always had a conversation. You know, it didn't matter who it was, you know. He would always talk to people.
The oldest of 10.
And I'm the oldest of 10.
How was it being the semi-leader of your tribe?
Now, that was a little, in the beginning, it was a little rough because, you know, you got your brothers and sisters that you're looking out for, and they're younger. So my next sister, she's 3 years younger than me, and then my brother is 4 years younger than me, right? So when I left Conti, they weren't there. You know, they didn't go to Eli Whitney. They didn't come there. So I was there by myself now, you know? So it was a little different than being at Conti where you got your brothers and sisters all around you, you know? And people know, you know, you're connected to a family. But at Eli Whitney, it was like, I'm a you know, lone wolf out there, you know? So that was a little hard, you know, when you're growing up where you know that, you know, there's family around, and then all of a sudden there's nobody. You're looking around and, you know, there's nobody you really can connect to, you know? And the other part of it is that I was small too. So that didn't help either.
Oh, okay. All right. You worked a lot of jobs, IBM and such, and early in your career, I'm assuming you were one of the only minorities in these positions. And how was that?
IBM was nice because in Norwalk, where I my office was, there were other blacks that were in that office, right? And what had happened is that when I was at Pitney Bowes, I had a territory where I met another IBMer from New Haven. So when I met him, you know, he was telling me about IBM. He said there's a lot of blacks in IBM New Haven. So I was like, wow. So when I finally got into IBM, then in New Haven, we would have meetings with, you know, that was our main office, really. We were all connected to it. So then I got to see the other guys, right? And then it was like, okay, there's more than me, you know, there's a lot of us here, you know?
But at Pitney Bowes, I'm assuming it was less at the time?
Less, yeah.
And how did you navigate that experience?
It wasn't that bad because there was always somebody that took me under their wing, you know? And there was an older guy who, you know, he showed me the ropes. We went on calls together, you know, so he taught me, you know, how to, you know, make my time, how to, you know, do the job, you know, all the little things that I needed to be successful in the work. So that was cool. But when I got to IBM, it was more like now I'm seasoned, you know, and so it was a question of just, you know, stepping up and doing what you got to do. You know, and then when I saw the other guys, then, you know, I had that guy who was already there. He became, you know, that mentor for me. You know, we all would do things together, you know, and there was a lot of times that we would even DJ sometimes together, you know. So because I was, you know, trying to DJ on my own at the time, you know.
You're listening to the Electric Drum here on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario. We're speaking with Bruce Trammell, author of The Village Coach, and we're getting a little bit of his background. So you said that you had a lot of people help you out. How important is it for you to be open and receptive to criticism and teaching and instructions.
Well, see, that's the thing is that, you know, Black men who help other men are not, you know, picking you off the street and saying, hey, you know, I want to help you. You see them at their jobs, you know. See, when you go to their job and they're there, you know, what they do is they, you know, just like if you would join a baseball team or something, right? You're the rookie, okay? You know, you get teased, you know, you get messed with and everything. It would be the same way on a regular job. Because I was working at a job here in New Haven. It was a factory. And when I went into the factory, I was about 18 years old. So these guys, you know, they would mess with me and mess with me. And then all of a sudden, you know, they saw that I did, you know, take that. I wasn't, you know, angry and jumping up and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. Then they took me under their wing and they taught me about how to manage your money, how to sometimes, you know, get a second job if you need it to, you know, so this would be your main job. How to, you know, make sure that you, you know, you buy a house when you get married, you know, put your family in, you know, you buy your nice car, you have your other little Humpty that you go around in, you know. So all of those things they would tell me and show me, you know. And after work, you know, we spend some time together, you know. All right, so this is how we, you know, we you know, calm down, you know, after work. And then you go home and you go to sleep. Because I was working like 3 to 11, you know, at a job like that.
Now, times have changed. Well, let's go back a little bit. You said that you have to have a little bit of thick skin. Do you see the lack of that now versus then? Or is the same?
No, right now, what I see is that a lot of guys feel that they got what they need already, you know, and what you're doing is you're invading, you know, if you help them out, if you offer a hand to them, you know, it's like, you know, mind your own business. I got this. I'm good, you know. But you did have to have a thick skin, but you also had to know when people were investing in you, were taking the time, you know, to give you direction. And that's what helped me on my whole manhood journey, is that there was always somebody there to give me some advice. You know, if I'm working construction, you know, the certain groups, you know, they're telling you, this is how we do it. You know, we give our money to our wives. This is how we buy homes. You know, this is how we live, you know, how we do lunch. You know, all of those little things, right? They would show you and help you. So everywhere I went, there was always a community that was already there. And all I had to do was be receptive to the community that was there and learn how it works. You know, like any job, when you get on the job, right? People are already doing things a certain way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do you, you know, go with that, or do you, you know, do your own thing? No, you go with the flow because it's already established, you know, they already have a way of working. So you work with them, you know, and then things go good.
How has the sense of community evolved over time?
Community has kind of changed because those guys aren't really there anymore because those jobs aren't really there like that, you know. It was a thing of men were home, you know, like at night, you know, sometimes you'd have the guy that would, you know, maybe the janitor or something. He wouldn't, you know, really talk all the time when you saw him. But every once in a while, he'd see a kid that, you know, kind of like would look up to him, and he'd give him advice. He'd, you know, help him out. You know, he'd talk to him. We had that with the barbershop, you know, like my dad took me down to the barbershop, told the barber that, you know, we had been going to, he says, my son is going to be coming here by himself now, you know? So, you know, just look out for him. And that's where we went wrong in our community, is that the father would know the community and he would introduce you to the community, you know? And that's what my father did. You know, he introduced me to this. He introduced me to that so that when I went to do things, you know, I had people looking out for me because they were doing it because they knew my father, you know? So that whole thing of the village, you know, of people looking out for each other was established by the men who were, you know, they knew each other.
That has changed over time.
That has really changed a lot over time, you know, because now we're in a situation where a lot of times people say, don't say nothing to my kid, you know? So that idea of, you know, me not saying nothing to your kid means that your kid is not going to get random pieces of advice, you know, from somebody who sees him doing something and not necessarily is, you know, scolding him or anything. It's just like, you know, hey, young man, how you doing? You know, what's going on? You know, what's happening with you? Or they would see somebody doing something, right? Like a man working on a car or working on something around his yard, and the kid is going by on a bike, right? And he looks at him, you know, one day, then he keeps on going. Then he comes back, you know, the next day. He keeps coming back until he finally looks at the guy and he says, I could do that. And he says, okay, yeah, come on over here. Let me see what you can do. I can do it, you know. And he can't, but, you know, he's waiting to be taught. You know, he's looking for that validation, you know, that this is what men do. You know, so is he looking for that example?
I was going to just say, there's a lack of examples out there. We're looking more towards these role models through social media. How important is it to have that direct example in front of you?
It's very important to have that direct example because we as young men, we get to choose what kind of man we're going to be, right? So I'll say it like this. There's the hustler, right? There's the addict, you know, grew up around a lot of addicts, right? There's the guy who he just goes to work every day and he comes home, you know, and he don't speak to nobody, you know? So you see these different types of men, right? And now you got to figure out who am I going to be, you know? What kind of man am I going to be? You know, what do I want to do with my life? And so if you've got somebody there that can help you, can, you know, bring you along, like I went to a job in New Haven here, and the guy who interviewed me, you know, older black guy, he's like, all right, look, I don't have a job for you right now. I'm going to call you later. I'm going to have a specific job for you to do. I want you to do that job. All right. And then when I tell you to do the other job, you know, we're going to switch you over. Okay. So boom, that's the way it's going to work. Did it. You know, he became a personal friend, you know. Looked out for me with a lot of other things. He taught me other things. He taught me about CBs and stuff like that, you know? That was when the CB area was, you know, everybody had vans and antennas and everything, you know? So we got into that as a hobby, you know? So just being there and being receptive and being open to, yeah, you're going to get criticized, you know? But you're also going to get taught, you know? Because you don't know it all. See, so that's what we're missing now is those guys who are there, who have that knowledge and who pass it on.
We're at that age. I mean, you grew up where radio was your babysitter, then television, then the internet, now social media.
Yeah.
How much more important is it for a parent to be involved in their children's lives?
It's really important because, there was a time when you had a latchkey kid, right? He'd be in the house, okay? Mom is going to work, you know, dad isn't there. And what he does is he goes into the kitchen, you know, he makes himself some food. He doesn't clean up, you know. He's in the living room watching TV. You know, he doesn't clean up. Mom comes home, you know, things are all, you know, messed up. Well, we went from that to a latchkey kid who stays in his room. And he doesn't go in the kitchen. He doesn't go in the living room. Mom comes home. Everything is good. But he's still locked in his room because he's on the internet and he's playing a game or he's talking to somebody. You know, everything he needs is in his room. You know, so mom don't have to fuss at him about the kitchen and the living room because he's not doing anything else. You know, he's not going outside. He's not leaving the house. You see, she don't have to worry about that. So that's a totally different way of operating, you know, because that kid is isolated, doesn't know what's going on in the real world. All he knows is what's going on that screen. If it ain't on the screen, as far as he's concerned, it ain't happening. He don't know what's happening in the world. He don't know what's happening in the neighborhood, you know. He's you know, contained in one little area.
So we went from knowing a whole community to just knowing our online community.
That's right.
Now we have how important it is to have, you know, what can I do as a human being for my child right now?
Okay. What you can do for your child is spend time with your child, just telling them how things were, how things work, how conflict works, you know, how arguments and all of those things work, because those are the things that our kids aren't always prepared for, you know. You know, years ago, what would happen is you'd be out on the playground, right? And you got picked maybe for a sport, right? But you weren't good at it. So they mess with you, you know. But over time, they would, you know, if you kept coming back, right, they kept, you know, giving you a little bit more advice, you know, they'll tease you a little bit still, you know, but they kept, you know, working with you and working with you. Before you know it, you know, you're up to speed because that was the community, you know. It was, you know, you were either in the group or you were just, you know, away from it, you know, but you were there. You got something from it. But now if you're isolated at home, who's to do that? You know, so it's the idea of parents really telling their kids how life really works because they can't get that from a room.
How was your transition from being a hands-on person to a paralegal? How did that go about?
Okay, so I was my kid was in a music orchestra, right? And there was another father that was there with his kid, you know. So we talk, you know, two black men with their sons, right? And he told me about the school, you know, that he was putting together, and he was a lawyer at the time, right? I said, wow, you know, if things had been different, you know, I would have wanted to be a lawyer. So he says, well, why don't you go for a paralegal? Start there. And I put it in the back of my mind, you know. I said, okay. So years later, I get to the point where I'm looking to do something different, right? And I go to the school, and they got two options. You could either go into nursing or you can go into paralegal. I'm like, okay, step closer to being a lawyer, right? You know, junior lawyer almost, you know, because you're doing the same work as a lawyer, but, you know, you're not really a lawyer, but you're the one that's helping him with the case. So I said, okay, yeah, let me do this. And then I saw that there was an opening with the state. It was a one-year position, and it's always that one-year position because what it does is it helps new lawyers and paralegals, right, to learn what the clerk's office is about. How do you take in, you know, when a lawyer comes and says, I'm going to start a case, you know, how do you take that information in? And then they would, you would be on trials with the judge. So you'd learn, you know, how the court works, the door, you know, how everything works in that room, you know, and how the paralegal that works with the judge is responsible for everybody that's in that room, you know. And I like that, you know, it felt really good doing it. So I ended up doing an internship at probation in New Haven. So while I was there, my buddy, he told me, he says, well, he says, Bruce, I got this DJ job, you know, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to let you do it. And it's with kids, you know. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And it turned out to be a job interview, you know, because what they wanted to see is that if I could work with kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I did the party, right? And it was cool, you know, and it worked out really nice. You know, the kids had a good time and everything. I even let some of them pick some music out, you know, and things like that, because it's, you know, their party, not mine, you know. So we did that. And the first thing this guy does is he says, let's go down to the court. He says, tell me how the court works, you know. And I told him, I said, you know, we do it like this. Da, 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 da. He said, okay, because what we're going to do is we're going to have you come down to the court and you're going to be there to help fathers, you know, when they're going through child support issues. And they're on the verge of, you know, maybe being jailed or something because, you know, they haven't paid the child support. So I said, okay, you know, I'm comfortable with this. This is fine, you know. And what he was doing was helping me to learn this business because he was eventually going to leave. He had already made up his mind that he was going to move on to something else, right? So he was looking to put somebody in his place. And so he taught me all about fatherhood. And I didn't even know it was a thing. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You know, I got divorced and, you know, I never saw nobody helping fathers, you know, when I was down there, you know, I went through all of this stuff by myself, right? So, yes, you know, there was help, you know? So I got into it and I liked it, you know. It was, you know, you're dealing with a lot of guys who, you know, they're upset, they're angry about paying child support, you know. But you learn how to work with them. You learn how to talk to them, you know. They give you stories. They, you know, they test you out to see, you know, if you're going to, if you're real, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a guy that came to my office, right. And he sat down and just looked at me. He's about my age, right? He had just come out of jail. Now, I heard that he was, you know, he was out of jail and all, right? And so I said, okay. I said, so what's up? He said, I just came to see if you were real. I said, so what you think? He said, yeah, okay, real. You know, that kind of thing where you have to be honest about what you're doing and what you're helping them to do, you know, because they've already been through so many people telling them, you know, stories and giving them false hope. But when you sit down with them and you talk to them and you listen to their story before you give an answer, you know, it makes a big difference. Now people can, you know, be vulnerable, you know, they can learn. And that's what I had learned over the years, you know, is that you listen to people's story, you know, everybody's story is not the same. And you never know what people are going through unless you take the time to listen to them. Because they know exactly what they need, you see, and they'll tell you.
And I guess you have taken all this advice and you put it into this book, The Village Coach. Where can people find out what are people going to get out of this book?
what they're going to get out of it is like, they're going to get my story. They're going to get lived experience, right? And they're also going to get tools, you know, to use. Because one of the things I tell the guys is that, you know, you got a toolbox, right? And we're going to put some tools in that toolbox so you use it. Now, I get that from auto mechanic, right? Because that was one of the first things that they teach you is you got to go to Sears, right? You got to get yourself a toolbox, and you got to get the tools you think you're going to need for the job. Here's, we're going to tell you what, you know, what you need. You get those tools and you put them in your toolbox, you know, and you feel comfortable with that toolbox because that's yours. You see, when you're on a job, you pull out the tool that you need. And if you don't have it, you go get another that tool specifically. So I use that to help them to see that, you know, everything I pour into you, you put into your toolbox. And when you need it, you know, when you run into conflict with the mom that you're dealing with, you know, you pull out a tool because you got a tool in your toolbox for that. You see? So that's what the book is going to help them. It's a guide from young manhood to manhood, you know, because men need to be validated. And that's the problem, is that, you know, when my uncle took me to the corner in Brooklyn, right, where these guys are standing around, you know, they got the fire going and the trash can and everything. They got the bottle, right? And they're telling stories. And they got the old guy, right, old school, okay? He's validating the stories, you see? They ask him, you know, old school, is it right? Is it true? Yeah, it's all right, it's, yeah. Oh, nah, man, that ain't really where it is, you know? So if it was good, you know, he got to take a drink, you know what I mean? So it's validating. That's what I learned, is that our young men need to be validated. And they cannot going to get that from their peers, because their peers are searching for the answers too at the same time. And that's where it takes an older man to step in and tell him, you know, you're a man, my son. Now I use Rudyard Kipling, his poem, If, as a way of, after it's all over, right? Then we go through that poem, because what that poem does is it tells them the steps. If you do this, you'll be man. If you do that, if you do this, if you do that. And in the end, he says, if you do all of these things, you'll be a man, my son.
Wow. OG, Bruce Tremell out here validating the struggles of young black men, young men in general, through his book, The Village Coach. Thank you very much, Mr. Bruce, for coming by. This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario saying thank you for your listen. You already know it's 94.3 WYBC in your community 365 24/7.
Thank you.